No one likes long introductions, and I agree, and I'll make this introduction short. I think I mentioned there'll be an opportunity to ask questions at the end anyway, but there's just a few things I want to mention. One of them is, it's a really remarkable thing, the tremendous burden that Ingrid has been carrying for the last 2 years. Now, a lot of people may not know this, but Ingrid is a dynamo anyway, and was before Ernst was taken away from her in February 2003. She produced the daily Z-grams, these email messages that were sent out to a very large subscriber list and often widely reproduced and reprinted and circulated. She is an author. She's written a book, a novel entitled The Wanderers, which I think is still available from the IHR. She's also the author of a trilogy entitled Lebensraum. Both books deal in some detail with her origins. She was born in a Mennonite community in what was then Soviet Russia, Soviet Union. And along with millions of other people, she retreated with the retreating German forces at the end of the war. That's alone a very little known chapter. How many millions of people actually retreated with the Germans because of the fear of Soviet occupation and Soviet oppression? And she was in Germany at the very end of the war under those very, very memorable and horrific circumstances. For a time, she lived in South America. And that alone is a very interesting story, and she perhaps can talk a little more about that. But after Ernst was taken away, in addition to the things that she had been doing, suddenly the burden of this immense legal campaign to secure her husband's release fell on her shoulders. And as someone who knows a little bit about legal battles and about fundraising and so forth, it's a tremendous job, a tremendous amount of work. And Ingrid deserves the respect and admiration of people everywhere for what she's had to carry during the last several years. It was especially shocking right after he was taken, Ernst was taken away. Of course, things move into a new pattern over time, but it's still a very terrible thing. She's alone there in a place that far away from where she had been. But part of the credit or blame for all of this goes to the IHR, because it was at an IHR conference, the IHR conference in 1994, that Ernst Zundel and Ingrid Rimland first met. And they say the course of true love is never an even and straight one, but eventually the two of them married, and the rest, as they say, is history. But perhaps they would have, their paths would have crossed anyway, but it was at an IHR conference that the two of them met. It's a great privilege, a great honor, and a pleasure to introduce Ingrid Rimland this evening. Please join me in welcoming Ingrid Rimland Zundel. I forgot. I was warned by my colleagues that just an announcement that anyone who hasn't paid the admission fee, who came in late, please do that. I want to also make a plea that the legal battle that Ingrid is fighting, and of course what the IHR is doing, is not inexpensive. And for those who can find it in their hearts and their pocketbooks, your support is very welcome. But again, Ingrid Rimland. Oh, and one other thing, yes. Oh, boy. I'm very pleased at the quality of the people who have come here this evening. Some of you are friends from many years. Others are people I've known only a very short time. Some, in fact, we've met only this evening. But I wanted to mention, in particular, a woman who is a friend of Ingrid's and has been for many years. That's Dr. Lorraine Day. Would you please stand up? When I ask her how should I introduce you and what can I say about you in 25 words or less, she ticked off a list of a long list of people who don't like her, but she also has many people around the United States who do like her. Lorraine Day is very well known as a alternative health activist. Her own battle against cancer is one that she's explained in great detail. Many of you, like me, may remember seeing her on television. But the reason she's here tonight is because she's has been for many years a friend of Ingrid, and at her own expense, last year she flew to Toronto to testify in the hearing that's going on there on behalf of Ernst. And she herself is a very remarkable woman for many reasons, not least of which is her willingness to stand up in defense of Ernst Zundel in this public way. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You are not going to get a canned speech today. I used to be a convention speaker. I did sometimes many years, up to 150 presentations, and I could just simply put myself on autopilot and give you the presentation there. I didn't even have to think about it. Today, I'm going to speak from the heart. It's not an organized speech. It's a speech that I feel is very important because so many of you who believe in the fact that we have been lied to in this world, and especially these last few years, do not know that so many parts of history have never been explained, have never been written up any place, and these people live among you who also have a story to tell, and Ernst Zundel is one of them. I am one of them. I always hear when we talk about Ernst Zundel this comment, we may not agree with him, but he has a right to speak. I believe that if you knew where he's really coming from, you would agree with him. It would not be a problem. So I thought what I would do today is tell you a little bit about my life, just very briefly, and then fuse that into when I met Ernst and what that meant when we joined forces and we took on what we call the lie of the century. As Marx said, I was born among the Mennonites. We were a very secluded, clustered group of people living in Russia. We had been called there to Russia at the request of Catherine the Great in 200 years ago, in 1789, I should be specific about it. And we were Germans in the middle of Russia. We never mixed, we never mingled with the Russians. We had our own communities, our own schools, our own churches. We had our own God who spoke low German. We knew that for a fact. And so we lived totally self-contained and always saw ourselves as Germans. Until the Russian Revolution came, the Communist Revolution came. And at that time, what used to be assets turned into liabilities, and we became the enemies of the state. Now, this happened when my grandmother was a young woman. When my grandmother was 27 years old, the Bolshevik Revolution was known to be a Jewish revolution. It was not a big factor in our life because at the time we were not well schooled in history. But I remember growing up with stories about Jews and about what they had done to us and that they had destroyed our lives and so on. But to say that we were anti-Semitic is simply not true because for us the entire story was a fictitious one. I thought that Jerusalem was a city in the sky. It was mentioned in the Bible. I did not know it was a geographic location. And so many of us lived like that. Now, in 1941, when I was a little girl, the men, the males in our community were herded together and were arrested and sent to Siberia. And my father was one of the very last who was taken like that. The story merges into the arrest of Ernst, as you will see later on. But my father was a principal in a high school in a town called Prieship. It was a Lutheran town, a German town called Prieship. And he did not know that he was going to be arrested. It was a Sunday afternoon. It was very sunny outside. He had a short-sleeved shirt on. I remember it because he was cutting a hedge, and I was standing there next to him, and he lifted me up and held me against his shirt, and it smelled of a hot iron. You know, when you iron a shirt, that's the only memory I have of my father physically. A man came up to him and said to him in Russian, "Are you the principal of this school?" And my father, who did not speak Russian all that well and who was a little bit hard of hearing, thought that the man had asked him, "Who is the principal of this school?" And my father turned to him with a smile and said, "I am the principal." This man turned around and denounced him for refusing to step down as a principal. It was a simple misunderstanding. My father was walked away, as Ernst was later walked away, without being allowed to go into the house and say goodbye to us. I never saw him again. I fear sometimes I will never see Ernst again. Because what plagued us then in Russia, what persecuted us then in Russia, has now come to America. It's here now. Right. We know what it was like then, and we have a story to tell that explains part of why it has come to America today. Now, when Ernst was arrested, he was inside in the garage in our home in Tennessee, and he was framing his pictures because he had bought himself a little gallery. He had fixed it up. The gallery was 2 weeks from being opened. And he was with his handyman. He was framing pictures. And I heard some noise. There were some cars coming up our driveway. And I went outside to see what it was. And they had Ernst against the hood of the car. He was spread-eagled. They were patting him down. And I said, "What's going on?" And Ernst turned to me and he said, "These people say I missed a hearing." And I said, "What kind of a hearing?" Because we were waiting for an appointment with the immigration officials. And somebody pushed a piece of paper in front of him and said, "Sign this." And Ernst said, "Can I read this?" And they said, "No, we don't have all day." And Ernst says, "I insist on reading this." And he did. And he said, "What will happen if I don't sign this?" He was requested to sign it. And they said, "Then we will have to arrest you." And he said, "And if I sign it?" They said, "We will have to arrest you anyway. We have come here to arrest you." There were five people there. Some of them had guns. And they took him away. He was not allowed to go into the house. He turned to me and said, "Get me my jacket and my passport." And when I came back, I gave it to him, and they took him away. He never was allowed to even say goodbye. It was like a nightmare that happened to me 60 years ago, happened all over again when they took Ernst. That's what happened. Now, let me tell you why Ernst is the way he is and why I talk the way I talk. We lived in Russia after the arrest of practically all our men for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, when order came for our entire village to be exiled to Siberia. And we were already at the railroad station, ready to be shipped to Siberia. We were sitting there all night long, and I remember it as a very noisy night, and train after train was going by there, with people being pushed and clubbed into these trains. My grandmother was beaten up, by the way, by that night. And it was literally a matter of hours, if not minutes, until it was our time to be exiled to Siberia also. The entire village was at that railroad station. When all of a sudden a giant hand came over that railroad station and silenced everybody, and we did not know what was happening. It was an eerie, eerie silence. And in the morning, with the sun coming up, our streets were flooded with the German army, the Hitler army, the Wehrmacht, came and drove our tormentors away. And for 2 years, we had peace in Russia. Now you people listen, there was no terror when the Germans came. So we lived until 1943, that the churches were being opened again. This was very important to us because during communist times the churches were closed. They were not allowed. They were used as chicken coops and so on. So when in 1943, Germany began to lose the war, they asked us if we would come with them. And we went willingly. Because had we stayed back, we would have been killed. We knew this. So this entire village, what was left of us, started walking westwards toward Germany. It was a walk that lasted about a year and a half, and we ended up at the gates of Berlin 2 weeks before the war was over. Now, there were 150,000 of us to start, and there were 10,000 that were left when we finished walking. They were left on the road. They died of starvation, of cold, toward the end of hunger. And people say, how did you survive? And I say, because the German army protected us. The German army fed us. They guarded us. They flanked us. They marched us into Germany. If it weren't for the German army, I would not be here today. I will not spit on the German army. I owe them my life. You see? Now, Ernst's story is a little bit different because Ernst was never on a track. He is a little younger than I am, so his memory is a little bit different, but he experienced the bombing. He knows what it felt like during the war, and he knows that the terror that came to Germany came after the war. It came after the war. It was not as bad during the war as it was after the war. Now, why are we not allowed to talk about this? Why is it so terrible if some of us say the war that has been told to America is not the war that we experienced? It was different. Truth is truth and lies are lies. And it doesn't matter if the truth is suppressed, it's still the way it was. Now, when we came to Germany, it was in the last weeks of the war. The Russian army overran us at the time. The horror that I experienced there, I have never really talked all that much about, and frankly, I don't even remember all that much, because at one point, I was lost in a forest. My family was gone. I was all by myself. I was surrounded by German soldiers, and the Russians had surrounded us from all sides, and they shot into that forest until nothing moved anymore. And I was there, and somehow I crawled out of there, and I have no memory of how I made it out. I found eventually my family. They had run into a farmhouse, and we reunited there. But I was there at that massacre. Now, did I go around yammering forever about what I had experienced? No. Because everybody around us went through similar experiences. So we lived in Germany for 3 more years, and after that we moved to South America because North American Mennonite churches came and collected us in the rubble of the German cities and shipped us in a group to South America. Now you ask, why South America? Because it was a country that needed farmers, and we were given land practically for free. I think we paid 25 cents a hectare, something like that, which is 2 acres, I believe. So I came to South America, to Paraguay, when I was 12 years old, and I lived there until I was 24. Totally isolated, totally cut off from anything or anybody. We had no schools. We were sitting in the early years outside on tree stumps. We were writing on our knees. The only book we had was the Bible, which was sent to us from North America. We had to memorize that, but it was an extremely primitive life. Now, the children that came into that colony were the survivors. We were the ones that were strongest, that had survived unbelievable things. We didn't know any other life. This was simply the life that we had, and that's where I grew up. Now, I want to say something else. Something very strange happened to me. When we came across the ship, with the ship across the ocean to Paraguay, there was a night when I was sitting outside, and all of a sudden, I felt such an unbelievably strong longing for my father, whom I did not know. I did not know where it came from because I grew up without a father. I hardly ever thought of him. Nobody had a father in those years. And I was simply practically beside myself with longing for my father. I never understood why that was until just a few weeks ago, and I will come to that as I come to the end. Anyway, I grew up there in South America. I was very aggressive. I was very strong. I was very self-assured. I did not have a formal education, nor did I miss it. I knew that I had survived. And I lived like everybody else, a barefoot life. We had mud huts. We had thatched straw roofs. There was just a small group of us in the village where I was, and we had one problem, and that was we did not have enough boys to marry because our men had been killed off or had been exiled. We were a community, a colony of women and children. Now, when you're a young teenager, you start looking around and you want to find yourself a husband. And that was hard enough in any case, but in my case, you wouldn't believe this now because I'm struggling with weight, but in my youth, I was a beanpole. I was as skinny as they ever come. Now, our standards of beauty were different. In order to qualify as a beautiful girl, you had to be fat. You had to be extremely fat. Well, here I was. For me to find a husband was a problem, but eventually I managed. I got myself one. And when I had my first baby, I could not nurse him because I was not equipped to nurse my baby. And we were very prudish people. We didn't talk about that. So what was I going to do? I walked my little baby into this hospital, into this primitive hospital, and gave him to a doctor. My child was just 6 weeks old. And I was too ashamed to tell him I couldn't nurse him. Now, in South America, if you cannot nurse a baby, that baby dies because you don't have refrigeration. You cannot. You have to run after a cow and milk a cow. I was embarrassed to tell the doctor I couldn't nurse my baby. I said, there's something wrong with him. He cries and cries. And the doctor says, without unwrapping the baby, he probably has a hernia. I need to operate on him. And he overdosed my baby and caused massive brain damage. And that was the reason why I came to America, to North America, in search of help for my child. It's a long story. I will not talk about it, what happened in between. Let me just say that at the time when Ernst Sundel ran for Prime Minister of Canada, I lived just around the corner. I had no idea he was there. And we often talk about that. You know, what would have happened if he had met me then? I don't know. I was very ignorant. He probably would not have interested me and vice versa. But anyway, he was there at the time, already a politician. I lived 7 years in Canada, and then I came to the United States again in search of help for my child. Now, I could read. I could always read for as long as I can remember. Somehow I taught myself to read in all this havoc of the war. But I had not had formal education. When you added the days and weeks I had been to school, it was no more than 3 years altogether. And I came to Wichita, Kansas, where we found a special school for our handicapped child. I was 31 years old. I had had 3 years of grammar school. And I walked myself into that university and asked them to educate me. And somehow I managed to get admitted. It's a long story, which I will skip also. But I was admitted. 4 years later, I had a BA. I went from there to an MA, and today I have a doctorate. It was a tour de force. Part of it was a search on my part to find out why these disasters had befallen me. What had happened to me? I had no idea about my history. I had absolutely no idea. I had my own experience. But what was involved in the Russian Revolution and what was involved in the fact that Germans came to rescue us, I hadn't the foggiest idea. So I started doing research at the library. The Mennonites have a library in a community called Newton, Kansas. And there I discovered what happened. I think I became a revisionist even then because I didn't even know what revisionism was. But I started reading and I started writing the story of my people, and that became my first book, The Wanderers. from there on, I wrote other books then, but I was a novice in history. It's hard to explain or hard to make you understand why that could be, that on one hand I learned so quickly and on the other hand I had no background, I had no frame of reference. And I remember talking to my mother about this once, or to my grandmother. I said, why did you not ever tell me about where we came from, what happened to us, and so on? I said, why should we talk about it? We've talked about it for centuries. There's no need to talk about it. Everybody knows it anyway. No, everybody didn't know it. But when I wrote The Wanderers, I did something that would today be called politically incorrect. At the time, I didn't know better. But I described the German army as heroes and not the villains that you have come to believe, simply because I didn't know better. And I, as I was reading it and started sending it out to publishers and so on, I came to realize that I had done something that could maybe cost me my head. But that was not the case, because I had described it in such a way that it was understandable. That book, even though it praised the German army as our rescuers, as our saviors, actually, won first fiction for California for that year. And I realized something that was very, very important, that if you tell a story from a personal, emotional point of view, people will listen and people will understand and they will not hold it against you. I became then a convention speaker. I have told this story 100,000 times, it seems like. Nobody has ever objected to my story. Nobody has ever called me names for the fact that I stood up for the German army. Only when I met Ernst Zündel, that's when the story changed. Now let me tell you how I met him. Somebody, I believe it was Hans Schmidt, I'm not even sure, somebody sent me some things that he had sent out. And if you know Ernst, he will dash something off and ship it out and not edit it, not do anything with it. He will just throw it at you. And I looked at that and I thought, who is that kook? And I wasn't that interested. And a little bit later, somebody else mentioned him again, and I called him. I called him from Stockton, California. Oh, maybe I was in San Diego already. No, I think I was still in Stockton. I called him, and I must have caught him at a bad moment, because he was not very friendly to me. I thought again, okay, that's it. He doesn't interest me. And it wasn't until this convention 10 years ago that I actually met him, and it was very funny. I walked up to him and I said, I'm Ingrid Rimland, I've tried to talk to you and you are not very nice to me. And he, in his ponderous way, pulls out his glasses, puts his glasses on, looks at me, turns beet red, and said, oh, it's you. And that's how we met. That's how we met. And I knew from the beginning that he was a truly exceptional man, because he, in a sea of rejection of the World War II German people, he was the only one that stood like a rock and defended him. So I said to him, I would like to help you. How can I help you? We met very briefly and we talked a little bit, and he said at the time to me, it's a dangerous business I am in. He said, there's a good chance I will be assassinated. Do you really want to get into that? And we parted then. He went back to Toronto, and a month later his house was arsoned, and went up in flames, burned his entire library, and he was rebuilding. It was a terrible, terrible time. He did not have time for me. Somehow, in June or July, I believe it was, I went for the first time to Toronto to see what was going on there. By that time, I had already started reading revisionist material. And the entire house was just a shell. It was, everything was burned and dirty and messy. It was absolutely awful. And I walked in there, and you know what I smelled? I smelled the war. I smelled the war. And I said to Ernst, the war has come to this continent. So we went up on the roof, And he said, must I be out of my mind that I am taking on an enemy that strong? And I said, how can I help you? I'll help you if you tell me how. Later on, we were sitting in his kitchen, and if you know Ernst, everything that he has ever owned is sacred. He will save it. He will save it to the end of his day. So he had this very old robe. It was very burnt. It had all kinds of holes. It was very dirty from this soot that was in the house. And I said, you know, I'll buy you a new robe. You don't need to wear this old robe. He says, no, I save everything. Look what I save. And he went into his pocket and he pulled out a handkerchief. He says, I saved this. And he went into his pocket again and he came up with a handful of money that somebody had given him that was almost burned up. There were $750 still left. And he says, look, I saved it. And I said again, how can I help you? And he says, well, you can start a website. And I said, what? I had never heard of a website. And he gave me that money. That money bought me 2 classes of how to do a website. And this is how the Zündel site came about. Now, it has been said over and over again, and it has cost Ernst hundreds of thousands of dollars, that he is accused of running my website. He had nothing to do with it. I did it by myself. I did it by myself. He has on occasion said my website, sure, because it has his name on it. But he never ever, to this day, he does not know how to do a website. He does not even know how to send an email. He is a horse and buggy man that way. But he was dragged before the Human Rights Commission and, you know, he was charged with running a website that was anti-Semitic and this and that. And it's my website. It's my website. When I started the website, again, I did not know how to do it or how dangerous it was or whatever. I simply started moving. Did 6 million really die onto the website? And I challenged his opponents to a debate. And all hell broke loose. The Wiesenthal Center went bananas. They went crazy. They wrote 2,000 letters to every single university saying, stop this website. Don't let this website out. Well, young students in America came and mirrored my website, copied my website, and put it up at their universities. And nothing happened to my website. It simply cloned itself. And the government lost. And the Wiesenthal Center lost. That was the first attack that was on my website. The second attack came in the summer when the German government indexed certain articles on my website that the German people were not allowed to read. Well, again, the young students came to my help, and they didn't even know me. I didn't know Ernst even. But they helped us to keep the website up. And then the third attack came at the end of 1996 when out of Nanaimo, which is the headquarters of that organization that I wanted to debate with us, started shooting into my website with these denial of service emails. There were 28.8 million letters shot into my website for 40 hours straight, trying to shut down the website, and it survived. It survives to this day. Ernst does not even have the password to that website. He never has had the password. In fact, one time he wanted to buy the website from me to just have peace and destroy it. And I said, no, you're not getting it. It's my website. So I guess he had no other choice but to marry me. No, it wasn't like that. But anyway, so I have helped him ever since, and I am very, very, very committed to this struggle and to revisionism. But my struggle is different from your struggle because I feel you are only getting part of the story of World War II. You have agreed that the Holocaust is a hoax, but you don't know how bravely the German army fought that war and why it was fought. And this part of it I consider also very legitimate. And that is what Ernst Zündel does. He is talking about World War II. Now he gets called names. I get called names. You wouldn't believe what I have been called. But the truth is the truth, and we must speak the truth as we know it. And this is what we do. Now, let me wrap up my story here about my father. My father was exiled to Siberia, and we did not know what had happened. He was in hard labor camp for 5 years, and then he was released, and he was told that his family had been killed. Now, my name in Russian, or the way I was originally, I wasn't baptized, but the name that was given to me was not Ingrid, it was Ina. That's how my father knew me, as Ina. Along the way, as we went to Germany, I had such a strange name. I hated it. And whenever we stopped in a different village and I had to go to school for maybe a day or two, I had to tell my name, and it was a big embarrassment to me. So I said, one day I said to my mother, I'm not going to go with that crummy name to yet another school anymore. This is it. So my mother said, pick yourself another name, get yourself another name. And I did. So this is how Ingrid came about. Anyway, but my father knew me as Ina. So when he was told that we had died and he had no way of finding us, he married again, and he had another baby, and he named that first baby Ina. That baby was born when I was on the ship. Yeah. Now, I often thought about, I eventually in 1960 through the Red Cross traced my father and found him living in Kazakhstan. This was still communist country, communist times. He was not allowed to talk to us, to write to us, only in open postcards. It's not much difference from the way Ernst is being treated now, where every word is being censored. Anyway, my father could not really say much, but he found us, and I found him, and I received 2 or 3 postcards where he told me that he was made to walk 2,000 kilometers, which is about 1,200 miles, on foot into the Siberian winter. Now, he had this child, he had a second child, and he eventually, because we could not correspond, it was very, very difficult. For me, as an adult, it was difficult to relate to my father because I did not really know my father all that well. And it wasn't until last year, maybe 2 years ago, when a woman contacted me and asked me if I was her half-sister. That was the Ina. She had moved to Germany, and through the internet, she had found me. Now, she wrote me a letter that I received just a few weeks ago. We correspond now. She's a simple woman. She's a very sweet woman. She told me some of the things of my father. But here's what she said. Dear Ina, many thanks for your dear letter, which you wrote to me in May. I have read it several times. What you experienced in the refugee years was really horrible. Imagine small children somewhere in the world without a home, walking into an uncertain future. I shiver just thinking about it. Thank God my sister and I did not experience that. Only slowly did we learn of the heartache of our parents. It shook us to the core. As I already told you, our father built a mud hut in a neighboring village. When I was a few months old, we moved in. It could have been the first or second week in October 1948. Maybe our father thought of you with very deep pain and longing. Perhaps he realized that he would never see you again. I have asked my cousin Edith if she remembers anything unusual, but she does not. I only know that our father asked all his friends if they knew anything about you. He kept a huge correspondence. I know that he knew that you were still alive and in a foreign country. He was too stunned to receive that first letter from you. At the time, we children did not even know that he had another family. We watched our father with a trembling heart. Would he now leave us? To me, he appeared to be lost, totally into himself. His blue eyes, which usually smiled at us, had turned dark somehow. He looked at me, but I had the feeling that he did not see me. After our meals, I loved to sit on his lap when he was reading the paper. In those days, after your first letter, I didn't dare, and since then, I hardly ever did. When our father died, I thought about writing to you, but I spoke very little German, and so our contact was broken. But I took that last letter of yours where you told us that your mother had died as well, all the way to Germany. I did not reply to that letter, but I kept all your photos and your address, and when I had learned enough German, I started to search for you. Yes, dear Ina, that's how it is, unfortunately, in life, where we develop differently in different directions. I was born and raised in a communist land, but I never bought into that ideology, but neither did I turn to capitalism. Everything having to do with politics is frightening to me. Too many contradictions stand behind it. I am truly sorry that I hurt you because of your husband. I didn't mean to come too close to you. I know nothing about his work. I'd rather not know so I can sleep at night. That is my sister. This is the message I want to leave to you with you. When you talk about my husband, Ernst Zündel, please do not do so with an apology. We too have a story to tell. There is nothing wrong with what he says. He is a very honest man. He has fought harder than anybody I know. There is another side to World War II, and he is telling it. This is what it's about. I thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
We have plenty of time for questions.
Yeah, okay. We have time for questions. Anybody? Have I intimidated you? Yes.
Yeah, you, in your newsletter, you said you stopped doing the Seagrams, and you're going to do this to wander around the country to get the message out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in other words, your Seagrams were very good. I get them, as you know, maybe you don't. But anyway, the deal is that you said you're going in another direction.
The other direction is this, that I feel that we need, maybe some of you will not agree and that's okay, but I feel we need a direction in revisionism. I think we have researched all there is to research. Now, are we going to argue forever with yet another Jew who's going to challenge us? No. We don't have to prove anything to the Jews anymore. We have the information up on the website. People can go and read there. And if they don't agree with them, let them go to their synagogues. We don't care. We want to go on. We should stop arguing with the Jews. That is number one. Secondly, I feel that we need to bring more emotion. We need to bring more flamboyance into our groups. I think there are many, many leftists, many liberals who are more than ready to come to our side because they're beginning to realize they're losing their country, just like Russia lost their country. And I think rather than arguing with each other, with ourselves, I think we should go after these people. We should befriend them. I have already begun that. I have half a dozen people that I correspond with. They are now beginning to carry my message very nicely, much more articulately than I can do it. And they are doing my work. They don't know it, but they are doing it. And I think that a lot of our very intelligent people should systematically seek out people who are not revisionists, but who are very unhappy with what is happening with America, and work it that way. Thirdly, I feel that we need to have something like a traveling convention. I think we need to move our convention systematically to other places. We should have speakers that are not revisionists. We should have others that are unhappy, that have a different slant, that are concerned with the way the world is going. but we need to bring more people into our community because our oldsters are dying off and we don't get enough young people in. Also, we do need to go after the young people. This is absolutely amazing to me, the impact we have on young people. I remember I spoke maybe 8 or 10 years ago up in Washington State at a junior college, and there was a handful of kids. We didn't have a large audience at all. We met afterwards for pizza someplace. I never knew that I had impressed them that deeply. Practically every one of them turned into a revisionist. And there was one particularly who kind of got on my nerves because he wanted 100,000 questions answered. And he was constantly after me. This man is now writing for Pravda. He's living in Russia. He is writing for Pravda, the revisionist vein. I had no idea that this kid was going to ever do that. So I think we need to really cultivate our young people. And I want to say something. There was a young lady who came with the baby. Where is she? I'm short-sighted. I cannot see that far. But anyway, she has two daughters that are singing at conventions. I think we need... They look absolutely gorgeous. They have little braids, and they stand there sassy. And I think we need to do that. We need to systematically invite them. I understand they sang at the half-aborted revisionist conference there in Sacramento. So we need to loosen up a little bit. We have to stop counting beans, for heaven's sakes. Let's not do that anymore. Also, I feel, and I have talked to many leaders in the revisionist community. I keep on asking, what are the means that we could have an international platform to let somebody judge this revisionist stuff? Because there will forever be another Jew who will challenge us, and we will scatter ourselves fighting with this one person who likes nothing better than make us run in circles all the time. So I think we need to look either at the grand jury, if that's the way to go, or an international symposium, or get a government to sponsor. I don't know how to do it, but I think we need to do something like that. That is very, very important. I have a special project, and I'm allowed to talk about it now. I am not allowed to say who is involved in it. Let me just say that it is very, very serious. We are doing a documentary, an honest-to-goodness documentary about Ernst Zündel, about his life, about his struggle. It's going to be 2 hours long. We are well on the way, and that is going to make a difference if we can, with DVDs, if we can peddle that in diverse communities and so on. Ernst has an absolute treasure trove there of videos and audios and booklets and things that have never been mined. I am still reading it. I am amazed at what is there. I think we need to raise funds to really make use of that. When we moved to Tennessee, we did not retire. We wanted Ernst to get his papers first. We were very, very hardworking. We laid the groundwork for what we hoped to be a think tank community. And, of course, the arrest has stalled that, but it has not been abandoned because by myself I could hold it together. We do have the property already, and it is already paid for the library and archives, a revisionist library and archives. We have sleeping rooms. We can have a start, and we want to branch out, not just Holocaust revisionism. We want alternative medicine. We want to find out what's going on in our air, in our soil, and we want to find out what the psychological mechanism are that make us run like rabbits every time somebody calls us a name. It drives me bonkers. Has anybody ever died because they have been called a name? You know, we have to have a mechanism to fight that. We shouldn't run and hide when somebody calls us a name because it is a psychological bullet aimed at your heart. Now, my friend Elena Haskin had a good suggestion. She said, every time somebody calls you a Nazi, you say, bless you. It's a reflex, you know. It's a reflex. So we need to have things like that. I think we need to loosen up. We should have more humor. And so there are many, many, many projects. Ernst and I are deeply into this. And he is the one, more than anybody else, that tells me that this struggle is not lost. This is just an interim an interim thing that has happened to him. It is unpleasant for him. He hates it. But this too will pass. And he wants me to tell you, I'm using this now in a short version, but he has told it to me in many, many words. He wants me to tell you that the ghetto will not win. No. Yeah.
What is your website?
It's Zundelsite, one word, ZUNDELSITE.org. Yeah. I should also say my website is not as much up to date as it should be. I have not had time to work it anymore. It is, it needs updating very badly. Actually, the IHR website is better. I have complimented Mark for that. Also, Germa Rudolph's website is better than mine. And so if you go to those three websites and you spend 2 days, if you have never heard of revisionism before, I think you will be hooked. So.
I wonder if you could say something about the legal struggle now, where things are, and where you think they're going.
Yeah, where are things now? He was arrested because he was supposed to have missed a hearing. What happened was this. Ernst has routinely taken out what is called a visa waiver, which is a 3-month permit to come across and leave the country again. He has done this for 5, 6, 7 years already. And in March of 2000, he took out a paper like that. He came here, and we consulted an immigration attorney, and were told that since we were married, he could stay here and apply for his green card, and nothing would happen to him. So this is what he did. But he did not come across in March. He went back in March because he had a business in Canada still, and he came back again in May. And by May, the visa waiver program had expired. The argument is now made that he has signed away his right by signing this green paper that he was going to stay only 3 months and then go back. When he came the last time, he did not come on the visa waiver program. He was simply waved through the gates, through the borders, as it was done at the time. So legally, we feel we have a very, very strong case. But we have a corrupt judiciary. People are afraid to give Ernst a break because of his reputation and because of his high profile. We lost our last habeas corpus appeal in the district court, and we are now appealing that again in the appellate court. We are asking for an expedited hearing. In Canada, the hearings have stopped on the security certificate. Allegedly, Ernst is a terrorist. That's what they say. They have kept him in solitary confinement for 2 years now. They have done just about any torture they could think of, short of electrodes. They keep him in an ice-cold cell. When without shoes, he has to stand on that icy floor when he stands up. He is not even allowed a chair. The light is on 24 hours a day. I sent him this little thing that you get when you fly to Europe, this little eye cover. It wasn't allowed because he could maybe harm somebody with that thing. He is atrociously treated in Canada. It is a disgrace to what they do to this man. And the one good thing that is allowed to us, and it's allowed to us, I'm sure, was for a reason, and that is he is allowed to call me practically every day, and we can talk unrestricted. Now, why do they allow that? Because they listen in on us. Well, let them. We have nothing to hide. Let them listen in on us. Who cares? So that is our comfort. This is how we stay in touch, and there are times when Ernst has a very difficult time, but most of the time he is holding his own. He is actually very upbeat. He says these are very interesting times, and darn it, I cannot be part of it. I'm cooped up here, So let nobody ever underestimate Ernst Zundel. He has said, and it's going to be in the movie that we're making, they will only take me out of Canada in chains or in a coffin. They will not any other way get him out of there. So, That's the story of Ernst. Legally, I do not have the vocabulary to be very intelligent about it, but this is the gist of it. Yeah. Anybody else?
Well, I just have a quick sort of broad historical question. Uh-huh. As an American, we're all taught to believe that Hitler and Germany of that era are the incarnate of evil, mm-hmm. and that America and our allies, including Russia, obviously to a lesser extent, were the good guys. This was a good war. How in opposition are you in general to that worldview that we in the West all cling to and believe in our souls? How wrong is that view?
It is, in my opinion, 85% wrong. Because you see, you have in Hitler a very powerful tool in that he is made as a devil. Nobody can say that a war is being fought that is always honorable. There are always atrocities, always. But what is being said of World War II Germany is simply not true. It is not true. And if you study the history of Germany, you will see that under the circumstances, Hitler did what he could do. He was not a perfect man, but he was democratically elected. He was passionately loved by his people. He was never abandoned even after the war. That must tell you something. That must tell you something. He loved his people. One thing is not true is that he wanted to take over the world. He had no interest in that. He wanted to have Germany for Germans. That's what he wanted. Now, did he treat the Jews badly? If you incarcerate somebody innocently, that is treating somebody badly. If you incarcerate somebody because he is part of a fifth column and he is hurting your war, is he not allowed to be incarcerated? You see, the Jews in Germany, and it was not everybody. There were even schools in Germany at the end of the war. The Jews had their own hospitals at the end of the war. I read someplace that there were, I think, 500 Jewish organizations in Berlin when Berlin fell to the Russian army. You know, it wasn't every Jew, but there were certain Jews that were a problem for Germany. And in order to isolate them, which is what you do in a war, he put them in concentration camps. Some of them were executed. Nobody was gassed. Nobody. Now, those who were executed for political reasons. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I was just going to say, the Americans put the Japanese in a concentration camp.
Sure.
They were innocent in California.
Yeah.
They didn't touch anybody in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
May I add something to that?
Sure.
I knew a person who worked at Dachau,
mm-hmm.
making parachutes.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that one day this rabid Jewish Marxist passed out gold coins and told them not to pack the parachutes properly.
They were sabotaging.
So about mm-hmm. 10 German paratroopers died because their parachutes did not open.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally they had an investigation. And when they found out mm-hmm. who had done it, they took him and made short shrift of him. Naturally, he was executed.
Mm-hmm.
But they also told them that we will not execute you, the people who made these parachutes.
Mm-hmm.
But in the future, if a parachute fails to open, you will die and your family members will die. And after that, all the parachutes open.
Hmm.
So, mm-hmm. in other words, it's not saying that there were not executions, but they were done because of treason and sabotage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened. Yeah. And also a very serious misconception here in America is that World War II was to kill every Jew in sight, that was the purpose of World War II. The purpose was to fight against communism. That was the purpose. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To what extent is your activism here in the United States now, you're speaking in various other activities, having an effect on proceedings in Canada or in a
I don't think they have ever taken me as seriously as they should have. They leave me alone so far. I don't think what I say hurts him. I think that Ernst has accumulated a debt with the Jewish organizations in Canada, that if he walked on water, it would not matter. They want to get his skin. Yes, back there.
Does Ernst have, is he undergoing a special appeal process right now because it seems to be at a standstill, what's going on in Canada mm-hmm. at the moment. They haven't deported him.
No.
And so what exactly is going on there?
I wish we knew, because the hearings stopped. The hearings were terribly unfair. That was a kangaroo court, if ever you saw one. There was absolutely no leeway given to Ernst at all. But the hearings stopped, and we were threatened that deportation to Germany was happening any moment now. And we thought, actually, on right after November 23rd, when the hearings stopped, that this was going to be it. It hasn't happened, and we don't really know how to explain that. I think part of it is that Germany is not all that eager anymore to get their hands on Ernst. You know, he has a worldwide reputation. They know him to be a fighter. They know him to be impeccably honest. He is very forceful. Now, does Germany, that is in trouble anyway, you know, well, let's not talk about that. But it is not in the Jewish interest to have Ernst in Germany anymore. So I believe what has happened is that they are stuck with him. They don't know what to do with him anymore. And if they were smart, which they are not always that smart as they should be, they would just simply let him come home, because Ernst wants to think things through. He is past the activism of the Holocaust. It is out there in the open. He does not want to fight that war anymore. He has said, I am sick and tired of the Holocaust. Now let me do something else more constructive, you know. And one of it would be to educate people in a positive way. There are many things that are wrong besides the Holocaust. He would like to do that. He would like to think in peace. We have had some wonderful years, there 2.5 years when nobody bothered us, and he was doing his little paintings and giving me his little speeches and so on. And I always I always wondered, after all this havoc that he had and all this success that he has had in Canada, what was he going, how did he feel about this quiet life that we had? Because we were living very, very quietly. And he said to me just recently, he said, I was utterly, utterly happy. So why don't they let him go back and be happy and not keep him there and have him be an irritant to the rest of the world?
It seems to me, if you don't mind, that the Canadian government mm-hmm. has created their own monolith here.
Sure they have.
And they now they have their backs against the wall as far as public opinion. Mm-hmm. And they've actually painted themselves into a corner.
They have absolutely. That's right. They have absolutely done that. And this is what I think happened. Because the idea was to very quietly nab him and ship him to Germany directly. Well, something went wrong. There was a holiday, and there was a letter of authority that didn't make it over the holiday, and he ended up in Canada. And there, immediately, he asked for asylum. And that started this whole thing, because they could not get rid of him, because he had made that application, and there they are, stuck with him. You know, he is like the American tar baby that you talked about. The harder you fight, the stucker they get, you know? Yeah. So.
Is there anything real going on with this United Nations appeal?
Well, they have asked Canada to explain themselves. They replied fairly rapidly. They have asked Canada to explain themselves, but they gave them 6 months to do so, so that doesn't help us much. Yeah, so no. They would not let him. They would not let him out. We think maybe what is happening in England, where the security certificate has been repealed or modified, I'm not sure just what they have done there, that might reflect on Canada, because the program itself, the security certificate itself under which he is being held, is under review. So will it be modified? Will it be thrown out? Will it be enforced? We don't know. We don't know. It is very strange that they hold him 2 months after the hearings are over. If they wanted to get rid of him, why didn't they do that? Germany is waiting. His friends over there would like nothing better than for him to come, because he has name recognition. You know, he is somebody that they can count on. And I have received hundreds of letters saying, why don't you let the guy come to us, to the homeland, to the fatherland? Let him come back. You see, if he goes back, I have a handicapped child here. I cannot leave. it would be the end of our marriage if he goes back, because I cannot leave. And if they imprison him there anyway in the beginning, you know, what good would it do for me to leave? So he is fighting largely because he wants to stay here and he wants to stay with me. But if he has to go to Germany, he will go. He is very committed. It is not the end of the world if they send him to Germany. So who knows? Who knows what will happen? I am just happy that I did not go by my initial impression and say I don't want anything to do with this guy. I learned differently. Yeah. So. Yeah.
Tomorrow, how can we help participate?
Yeah, let's talk about that. I wish as many of you as can come would come to this demonstration. You don't have to stay there long, but we have some signs, and the signs say shame on Canada, and I would like as many of you who have the guts to do this to hold those signs up, because I will have a cameraman there to film it, and it's going to be in a documentary. Not only that, it's going to go around the world to all these papers. They will see shame on Canada, and if that doesn't work, we will think of something else. We are going to fight until we get our men back, or until we have this problem that we have on our hands neutralized. Pardon me?
What time?
Noon, right?
Noon. Tomorrow?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it tomorrow, right?
Yeah. It's tomorrow at noon at 550 South Hope Street in downtown Los Angeles. It's right near the Central Library. We'll be bringing signs. We encourage people to bring their own signs, but we'll have some as well. We've had quite a few ones that say, "Shame on Canada," as Ingrid was mentioning earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're welcome to bring your own signs. I just want that line up so that we can take that. If you want to have your own say-so, do so. It's okay with me. I just want that because I know how very powerful that was. The kids up north in Washington State had a lineup like that where it said, "No more wars for Israel." And that picture went around the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is much more effective to have one message, concise, than to have 100,000 and you say it's just another demonstration. Who cares? Yeah. Okay.
Will an audio tape of this program be made available?
I suppose so. Later on I will listen to it and say, "Oh my God, I was so inarticulate." I'm always critical about myself later on. Then I don't like it, what I did and what I said. But yeah, probably. I also have some from before that we made, and Ernst has many, many good tapes. So, one more.
Besides demonstrating tomorrow, on your website, does it have if people want to send letters of support to Ernst, do they send them to you, or do
you can send them to me, and I will pass them on. That is one way. I tell you what the problem there is. It sits forever with the censor. And they hate getting many letters. In fact, it's a big problem in the prison. Ernst constantly gets hassled because he gets so many letters from everybody. So now they're punishing him by withholding the mail, and a lot of the mail disappears. And I have found that if I bundle it and I send it FedEx, it has a better chance of getting there. So if you send it to me, my address is on the website, then that's better. So that's it, I guess.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.